Thanks very much, and thank you very much to the organizers, especially Karen, who had to put up with me changing my title twice so far. I might still change it again, but and actually, this title sort of occurred to me late at night when I was remembered a talk that Bill gave at the Kirby Fest, actually, back in 98, and the title of his talk back then was Are Three Manifolds Transparent? Diamonds, Glass, and Surgery. And it was a very interesting talk and kind of very inspiring. And what was really interesting, one of the many interesting things about it was that Bill was sort of talking at the end about how he'd been talking to some fellow at UC Davis who was a retired material scientist, and he was sort of being really excited by and inspired by some ideas in material science. And I think one of the many lessons I learned from Bill is that mathematics is not divorced from the real world. It's sort of part of it, and you know, we sort of think in metaphors, and if we can get those metaphors from as wide a range of areas of life as possible, literature or science or aesthetics or our own sort of personal interactions with people, those are very powerful metaphors that we can then turn into mathematics and vice versa. So I want to start by discussing two visions of group theory, and I don't want to suggest that these are competing visions, but they do sit in a funny relation to each other. So this is part zero. Two visions of group theory. And here, for group theory, I'm always interested in finitely presented groups or occasionally finitely generated groups, but overwhelmingly I'm interested in finitely presented groups. And so one vision of group theory, and I'm going to abbreviate this as GGT for grumpy group theory. So this is a very pessimistic view of group theory, and it says, you know, that there are lots of interesting things we might want to know about groups, and if someone hands us a group, a finite presentation of a group, there are a lot of questions we might want to know the answer to, but everything's sort of hopeless. So this vision of group theory says all interesting questions about finitely presented groups are unsolvable. There are monsters everywhere. You know, Tarski monsters, groups with two conjugacy classes, all kinds of terrible phenomena make understanding hopeless. And, you know, you might as well give up. That's sort of more or less what this sort of vision. And I want to contrast this with another vision of group theory, which I want to abbreviate by GGT for generic group theory. And here, rather than talking about the worst possible examples of groups and how bad they are, you know, it's a little bit like reading the news. It's the news every day. They tell you what the worst person in the world did that day. Instead, this is the silent majority here. Most groups. What are most groups like? Well, most groups are great. Most groups are very well behaved. In fact, they're hyperbolic, which is the best thing a group can be. They have lots of interesting subgroups, which are easy to understand. And you can find these things easily and certify the properties that they have quickly. So let me just sort of say, Yeah, so easy to find and certify. I'm regretting taking Kurt's advice and throwing away my slides, but anyway. Not really. Okay, and so I want to put a bit of content into this, and there's an additional thing that I hope to be able to say something about towards the end, which is that there's not just groups in isolation, but there's kind of a landscape of groups, and the generic point of view informs this landscape, and groups can be related by melting and freezing. So here to use a kind of a metaphor from material science, which I think is more than just sort of superficially related to what sort of Bill was talking about in his lecture. But by the way, if you are interested, and here's how forward-thinking MSRI are, this talk back in 98 is available. You can watch it on the internet now. So right now, if you've got your laptop with you and headphones and stuff, I guess. All right, so what do I mean by, and by the way, the idea of using the same abbreviation for both of these themes is that I think both of these things are worth taking very seriously, and they do, in fact, both describe aspects of GGT, geometric group theory, and the fact that there are these competing aspects of the same object is part of the richness and interest of the subject. Okay, so I want to start talking about what do I mean by generic? What are most groups here, most finitely presented groups? So I want to talk about random groups. And really, it's random presentations of finitely presented groups. And so there's several different models of what you might mean by a random group. And some of them have peculiar features that are kind of interesting, distinguish them from others. They have a lot of features in common. I'm going to talk especially about two such models, both sort of introduced by Gromov and studied sort of extensively. And so the idea is we first fix some number k at least to free generators. So here's our group, a random group over here, has some number of generators. And then we're going to add some relators so that we impose some relations. I'm going to call L relations RI. And so far, so good. And the way in which we impose these relations are going to be, let's say, of length n. Well, I haven't told you what n is yet, and I haven't told you what L is yet. So there's two different models, and so there's the few relators model. That's where L, which you might as well take it to be bigger than 0, is fixed. But then there's the parameter, so n here is the parameter. So really there's a couple of constants. There's k, the number of generators, at least 2. There's L, the number of relators, at least 1. And then you sort of vary the length. You sort of say, well, okay, I want a random 2-generator, 7-relator group. And I want to know what properties such groups have. And well, you say, but how long are the relators? Well, you say, I want them to be sufficiently long when the length is big. So the relators Ri have length n, and I choose them randomly. They're chosen randomly and independently from amongst all reduced words of length n in this fixed free generating group. So words of length n in the generators and their inverses, which are reduced, you never have a generator next to its inverse. And you choose each one. Well, there's a finite set of such things, so there's a natural probability measure, just the uniform measure on that set. You pick one out of the box, you add it as a relation, you pick it out, pick another one out, you add it as a relation, you pick them all out independently from each other, and you write down, once you've got L of them, there's your presentation for your group. And then what you're interested in is you're interested in properties of the group that hold with high probability when N gets large. So for each fixed N, this is a finite collection of groups. It's hard to say many impressive theorems about finite sets, but for any given fixed N, this is a finite collection of groups. If there's a property that you're interested in, some of the groups have that property, some of them don't, so there's a probability of that property holding as a function of N, and you want to know what are the probabilities that hold with what are the properties that hold with probability going to 1 as N goes to infinity. And then one says a random group in the few relators model has whatever property it is with overwhelming probability. That just means when N is big, it's very likely to have that property. And in many of these, of the property cases of properties that we're interested in, the probability goes to 1 very quickly with N. So quickly that one can sort of observe it in the laboratory, which is to say on the computer. So this is one model, the few relators model. There's another model, which is the density model. So how many reduced words are there of length N in a free group of rank K? How many elements of word length N are there in a free group of rank K? Well, the first letter of your word could be any of the generators or its inverses. There's 2K of those. But each subsequent letter, there's 2K minus 1 choices. Because it's a reduced word, it can't be the inverse of the previous letter. So up to kind of order of magnitude, the number of reduced words of length N is 2K minus 1 to the power of N. So in the density model, you choose a density in advance, and then for each N, the number of relators you add is just, well, of all the possible words you could have added, you add some with a particular density. But there's a kind of a twist to it, which is it's a logarithmic density. The number of relators you add is, well, this number 2K minus 1 to the N times D. And here D is the density. D less than 1 is the density. And it's a very interesting model because these groups have a lot of interesting properties which depend in kind of a very satisfying way on the density. So one thing that gives this theory really some substance is the Gromov sort of noted right at the sort of start of the subject that there's a very beautiful phase transition that holds with respect to density. So so he showed that at density at least a half, the group is either trivial or Z mod 2Z with overwhelming probability, meaning as N gets big, you're pretty likely to have just written down the trivial group or the group Z mod 2Z. Whereas at D less than a half, the group G is infinite, an infinite group. It's torsion-free. It's two-dimensional. What do I mean by that? I'll say more precisely in a second. And even more than that, I can sort of, it's hyperbolic and one-ended. So it's not like a free group. It's some kind of interesting group. It's an infinite group, but it has a lot of sort of nice properties of it. And so, you know, you're supposed to give a proof in every talk. And so it's the reason why there's this sort of phase transition at a half. The reason why half is important is kind of for a very elementary but important reason, which is it's a kind of a pigeonhole principle. But it's not the usual pigeonhole principle. Usual pigeonhole principle says if I have 1,000 pigeonholes and 1,001 pigeons, then one of the pigeons has to move to another hotel. There's going to be at least 2 pigeons in one pigeonhole. Okay? So the random pigeonhole principle says, if I have a million pigeonholes and 1,000 pigeons, or 1,001 maybe, plus or minus change, and I put them in pigeonholes randomly, then the odds are two pigeons will have gone into, there's going to be some pigeonhole with two pigeons in it. And the reason for this is kind of really nice because, well, there's 1,000 pigeons, but there's 1,000,000 pair of pigeons. And what you're asking is the probability that there's a pair of pigeons in the same hole, and there's 1,000,000 holes and 1,000,000 pairs of pigeons, so one hole gets a pair, roughly. That's how probability works. I think. All right, anyway, so what? Well, if I have a random word of length n in the generators, and there's that many possible words, 2k minus 1 to the n, but I take the square root of that number words, the chances are the same word came up twice. The odds are R1 is, well, not R1, but R17 billion happens to be R23 Googleplex or something, right? And so you're going to have a coincidence. Well, again, so what? You could add the same relator twice in a group, it wouldn't matter. But if you're likely to have a coincidence, you're likely to have an almost coincidence. The chances are there's going to be two relators which differ in exactly one letter, say the first letter. And if they differ in exactly one letter, well then in this group, one relator is equal to the identity, the other relator is equal to the identity, so one times the inverse of the other is equal to the identity. So if they differ in only one letter, one of your generators is equal to another one of your generators. And this happens maybe 2k times, and every generator is equal to every other generator and also equal to its inverse. So your group factors through z mod 2z. Okay, so that's sort of the proof that above density 1/2, g is 1 or z mod 2z with overwhelming probability as n goes to infinity. It's a very satisfying observation. The fact that it's not true below 1/2, that this really is the cutoff, this is a really beautiful observation, and it makes these groups have a kind of beautiful kind of quality to them. Okay, so other sort of properties of these groups, one can say more about them. So Damani, Girardel, and Shatitsky, there's the R, showed something more about these groups. So these groups are hyperbolic and two-dimensional. If you have a hyperbolic group, its boundary is a nice compact topological space. And if it's a two-dimensional group, its boundary is a nice compact one-dimensional topological space. And it turns out to be as big as it can possibly be subject to those constraints. They show that the boundary of G is the Menger sponge. So this is a really nice space. It's the biggest compact one-dimensional Hausdorff topological space, meaning that all other compact Hausdorff one-dimensional topological spaces embed in it. And it's kind of really nice. It's just basically a cube, but then you sort of drill out some subcubes from it, and then you drill out smaller subcubes from the subcubes you haven't drilled out, and smaller and smaller, and you know, kind of eventually you've just drilled kind of everything, or sort of all the interior out of it, and you're left with this sort of one-dimensional, wispy kind of thing that's left over. So I like maybe call this the poor man's Swiss cheese, because the measure is zero. Okay, so that's what the boundary of these groups look like. What do I mean by two-dimensional? I need to say something a little bit more sort of topological about that. So I don't have an algebraic brain. I don't do groups and algebra really. I think much more in terms of spaces. I think a lot of us here do the same. And for me, a group is always the fundamental group of something. And so, well, if there wasn't a thing around, well, you'd make one. And so you can build a two complex. So let me stress here, what we've got is a probability distribution not just on groups, but actually on presentations of groups. And if you have a presentation of a group, then you can build a nice two-dimensional complex whose fundamental group is your group. So there's a complex K, two complex K, with one zero cell, with a bunch of one cells, one for each of your generators, and you attach a bunch of two-dimensional disks, one for each of your relators. So you're attaching the boundary by R1, R2, up to RL. That gives you a two-dimensional complex. And so pi 1 of k is g. And then what do I mean by sort of two-dimensional here? I mean that this space k is a kg1, meaning its fundamental group is g, but all its higher homotopy groups vanish. And this is equivalent, because it's two-dimensional, it's equivalent to saying that its two-dimensional homotopy group vanishes. And another way of saying that is that there's no interesting map from a two-sphere to this space. Well, what's a map from a two-sphere to this space? Well, it's a two-dimensional complex. You map a sphere into this space. Here's a two-sphere. If you mapped it in, mapped it into a space, then, well, you'd pull back the one skeleton, and you'd get a nice graph on your two-sphere. And each of your two cells here would pull back to a two-cell, something like that. And then I need another color. A long time to decide what color I want. Okay, and then you sort of think of this, a two-sphere. What's a two-sphere? It's the northern hemisphere union, the southern hemisphere. So if I sort of look at the equator here, it goes around the back, and if I read off that, what is that? That's an orange curve. It's going to map into this one skeleton. It's a cyclic word in the group, and I've written it as a product of green words, conjugates of green words. That's what the southern hemisphere is. The southern hemisphere witnesses the fact that this word is trivial in the group, and the northern hemisphere also witnesses the fact that this word is trivial in the group. And the statement that this map of a sphere into this complex is homotopically uninteresting means that this coincidence is uninteresting. It means that you can write a word, as if a word is trivial in the group, it's trivial for essentially only one reason. That's a way of interpreting this. And if a word's not trivial, well, you can kind of shorten it in a kind of canonical way and find a nice representative of it. And so all kind of interesting questions you want to ask about this group, you can decide them at the level of elements and presentations, words and presentations, very easily in practice because of the geometric features of this space and this group. So this is sort of the strong contrapositive to these sort of pessimistic theorems, that these random groups, all the naive questions you might want to ask about groups and general elements and relations and things like that, they can be answered reasonably simply. And the straightforward naive answers are usually correct. If you want to know whether two words are the same, represent the same element, if they don't look the same, they're probably not the same. It's sort of that easy. Okay, so that's random groups themselves, and that's sort of the end of the story. I mean, they have some interesting properties. There's some extremely interesting phenomena that occur in some densities and not in others. An amazing theorem due to Wise, and then generalized by Wise, Olivier says that at density less than a sixth, I think I have this right, these groups G are actually virtually special. Well, okay, so.
Virtual special.
Yes, it does. I was just about to, yes. Plus Eigel. But they show that it's NPC cubulated and hyperbolic. And that's sort of, it's kind of amazing that this sort of random group that you just wrote down generators and relations completely at random in just a higgledy-piggledy way, and maybe astronomically large numbers of relations, these groups virtually embed in right-angled Artin groups. And I think this is kind of a just sort of an astonishing fact. Really, there is some restriction on the density because at density bigger than a third, actually these groups have property T, and this is sort of in one model first proved by Zuck, and then sort of slightly different model by Katowski. Okay, so these are incompatible things. So there's definitely some separation between these two sort of buckets here. All right, so these groups, they're very interesting. At some densities, they have some properties. At others, they have whatever. So these are the groups themselves, and you say, okay, fine. And then a natural question to ask is, well, okay, these groups are great, but they're not that familiar to us. Can we sort of understand them better by finding subgroups in them which are more familiar? So that's the next thing I want to talk about is subgroups of random groups. So the next part of my talk is sort of grew out of a long-term joint project with Alden Walker, and some of the most recent stuff is joint work with Henry Wilton. So a lot of what I'm going to talk about today builds very, very much on joint work with Alden and with Henry. So part two, subgroups. Okay, so there's a basic question, in fact, which is, how do we construct subgroups of groups at all? Well, one kind of way to do it is to build a map from a group into your target and then try to find conditions under which that map is an embedding. So the idea is we want to build these groups, we're going to build some subgroups in such a way that we're going to construct spaces whose fundamental groups are things we understand, and we're going to do it in such a way that these spaces come with maps to our complex K, and so the fundamental groups of these spaces, these groups we understand, come with homomorphisms to our random group G, and if we're careful in our construction, then these subgroups, these maps will be injective, and then we'll have exhibited our subgroups as subgroups of G. But if I'm really working in here the world of generic group theory, and I really want only to prove things that are easy, I want to be very careful not to prove hard theorems, because hard theorems are sometimes hard to use. I don't really want to show that there is some subgroup in there if it's really hard to find the subgroup, and it's hard to certify it, and it's hard to use it. I want to find the subgroups that are easy to find. So the question is, what are the subgroups that are easy to find? Well, the technique I want to use is geometry. I want to find subgroups whose intrinsic geometry reflects the way in which they're embedded in the ambient group. And this is a technical word for these. I'm looking for quasi-convex subgroups. So quasi-convex just means the intrinsic geometry of the subgroup, sort of thought of as a group itself, reflects well the extrinsic geometry of the way it's embedded in the big group. So if you have a hyperbolic group and you have a quasi-convex subgroup of it, then the subgroup of it is also a hyperbolic group. And the boundary of the subgroup embeds in the boundary of the ambient group. Well, how much space is there? There's exactly enough space for any hyperbolic group whose boundary is one-dimensional. That's exactly the topological amount of space that we're allowed in there. So there's a few examples of groups we know whose boundaries are one-dimensional. We can ask whether we can find them as subgroups. Okay. So what's the sort of simplest example of a space that might arise as the boundary of a hyperbolic group? Well, one example is a Cantor set. So a Cantor set could arise as the boundary of a group. That could be the boundary of one of our subgroups. So we're going to look for a subgroup H, quasi-convex subgroup of G, and so the boundary of H is going to embed in the boundary of G, so it better be most one-dimensional. So the Cantor set is a perfectly nice space. It's zero dimensional. It certainly will embed in a manga sponge. And you can say, well, what groups have boundaries which are Cantor sets? And the answer is basically virtually free groups. So these are, H is virtually free. And you ask, well, does a virtually free group embed in our random group? And the answer is yes. And actually, much more than that is known. Every hyperbolic group, every non-elementary hyperbolic group, actually has lots and lots and lots of free subgroups. There's a very robust construction of them. So one of the most powerful techniques we know for constructing subgroups of groups in general. So these exist in all hyperbolic groups by, it's called the ping pong lemma, or sometimes Klein's ping pong lemma. So there's a general technique to construct free subgroups of arbitrary hyperbolic groups. Okay, so this is the Cantor set case. So the group, the boundary is completely disconnected, just a bunch of sort of dust. So if you have a hyperbolic group whose boundary is disconnected, then actually a beautiful theorem of Stalling says that your group virtually splits over a free group. So morally speaking, it's a free product of simpler pieces. So if we're prepared to sort of say that freeness we kind of understand, free products we kind of understand, we might as well pay attention, restrict attention, to cases where the boundary is connected. So let me just sort of say here, if boundary is disconnected, H virtually splits over trivial group, and this is by Stallings. So that's sort of allowing us to skip over to the next stage here. The next simplest example is S1. So S1 could be the boundary of a hyperbolic group. And now it turns out this is if and only if H is virtually pi 1 of a closed surface. And so this uses work of lots of people. And I, you know, if I write really small, you can't tell I haven't actually written all their names. But you know. Well, anyway, lots of people are involved in the proof of this. It's an awesome, awesome fact. We really know you've got a hyperbolic group, the boundary is S1. You're virtually a closed surface subgroup. This is a terrific theorem. And so you say, well, can we embed a closed surface subgroup? What groups can we embed it in? And so there's a really amazing breakthrough a few years ago was made by Kahn and Markovich, sort of built on some earlier breakthrough work of Lewis Bowen. And they showed that actually we can find in hyperbolic three-manifold groups. So this is they have a technique, a very powerful technique, using sort of ergodic theory and sort of probabilistic methods to construct surface subgroups in hyperbolic three-manifold groups. This is sort of one of the very first examples I know of a really powerful technique of constructing non-free, not virtually free, subgroups in big classes, interesting classes of hyperbolic groups. So using some methods which are much more combinatorial, but I want to acknowledge a sort of a spiritual debt to the ideas that they had. Alden Walker and I managed to show that we can find such things in random groups. So random groups are as good as hyperbolic three-manifold groups from this point of view. We can sort of keep pace with them. They contain, in fact, fundamental groups of closed surfaces. You can find them in random groups. So that's great. There's room for circles in the boundary, so you hope you can find some surface subgroups, and actually you can. So in between, at the next stage here, the thing about the circle is, well, it's not disconnected, but it can be disconnected by removing a pair of points. It can be locally disconnected by removing points. It has these local cut points. And so local cut points, so if you have a hyperbolic group whose boundary has local cut points, then Boditch shows it actually virtually splits over Z. So this is Stalling's Boditch. Okay? So again, if we're prepared to take our group and we understand maybe splittings over Z, these are the cylinders. Z is pi 1 of a cylinder. So groups which split over Z are cylindrical. Those that don't are acylindrical. It took me a depressingly long time to realize that was the origin of that word. These ones can be inductively sort of, you can decompose them into these simpler groups, cut them along, you know, cylinders and cut them along finite groups or whatever. So we might as well restrict attention to groups whose boundary has no local cut points. And so the next simplest guy after the circle is this Sierpinski carpet. So the Sierpinski carpet is, well, it's not completely misleading to say it's like a face of the Menger sponge. So it's planar. I need a, all the good colors are way over here. Yeah, yellow, that'll really contrast. Sierpinski carpet, well, let me draw it over here. So I'm going to draw it like this. I'm going to drill out circles to kind of really make the Swiss cheese metaphor even more, whatever. But it's sort of, these are tiny, tiny little circles here. It's a planar thing. So this is one-dimensional, compact, Hausdorff, and planar. The Menger sponge is not planar. And this guy is universal with the property that all one-dimensional, compact, Hausdorff, topological, planar topological spaces embed in it. And now, Sierpinski carpet, while it'd be great to have a characterization of groups whose boundaries were Sierpinski carpets, but we do have a conjectural classification, and this is, I don't think this is quite as general as the Cannon conjecture, but it certainly would be implied by the Cannon conjecture. Sierpinski carpet boundary, if and only if H is virtually pi 1 of a hyperbolic 3 manifold with totally geodesic boundary.
Danny?
Yep. Yep. Yep, it is. I was trying to do a table here, and so if I turn the blackboard on its side, I might have more help. Let me move to a clean blackboard. Okay, so dot, 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 dot. Cannon's conjecture says your boundary is a Sierpinski gasket if and only if you are virtually pi 1, so virtually pi 1 of a hyperbolic 3 manifold with totally geodesic boundary. Non-empty totally geodesic boundary. And so the idea is that your totally geodesic faces in the universal cover, these are totally geodesic planes which limit to round circles on the sphere at infinity, and you cut out the disks that these round circles contain. Well, you cut out one disk from the sphere and you're left with a disk, and then you cut out all the other ones. So what you're left with is this very thin slice of Swiss cheese, the Sierpinski carpet. Okay, so that's why that's the limit set of these guys, but conversely is the conjecture. And now I don't know of a general construction of such guys as subgroups. And I think it might have been fair to wonder whether such groups could really be found, constructed very easily in ambient groups. So François Damani actually explicitly asked whether random groups could contain such subgroups, just on the basis that at least there's no obstruction at the level of their boundary. The boundary is in bed. That's good, so they've got a chance. And actually, in fact, this turns out to be true. So this is sort of this joint work with Henry Wilton. So we show, in fact, that a random group does, in fact, contain, with overwhelming probability, and the probability goes to 1 pretty fast with n, in fact, Many subgroups which are pi 1 of hyperbolic 3 manifolds with totally geodesic boundary. Okay, so that's a little bit surprising, maybe. Well, then you say, all right, that's got to be kind of it, because beyond the Sierpinski caput, what else is there? Well, you've run out of splitting theorems, and they've run out of subspaces. So I did want to make a kind of a table here, but I don't have a splitting theorem to put here, but maybe I'll put a question. So here we were talking about being kind of disconnected by nothing, and then we were being disconnected by a point. And so it's sort of interesting to ask, what can you say about a hyperbolic group whose boundary can be locally disconnected by an arc? And so here's a question. If the boundary of H can be locally disconnected by an arc, does H, well, splitting maybe is too ambitious to ask for, but let's just ask, does H contain a codimension 1 quasi-convex surface subgroup? So here I mean codimension 1 in the sense of Danny's talk. So the kind of thing you could split over if you knew that you could split over codimension 1 subgroups here. So for example, if we were talking about, well, subgroups of random groups at low density which are cubulated, we would know by Agol-Wise that we could separate, and so we could actually, if we found such things, we could virtually split over them. But can we find them? So this is sort of an interesting question because I think it neatly falls into two pieces. One where the boundary is planar, in which you're really just asking the Cannon conjecture, and I have nothing to say about that, other than it's a really hard conjecture. And then the case where you're not locally planar, in which case these intervals are kind of quite rigid. And if they're rigid, they're probably stabilized by a lot. And if they're stabilized by a lot, the kind of thing they're stabilized by is bound to be something like a surface subgroup. So that's the kind of picture.
Question?
Yes? Well, locally disconnected by an arc. So a two-dimensional surface is locally disconnected by an arc, and the only examples I know of two-dimensional surfaces which are boundaries of hyperbolic groups are two spheres, and the Cannon conjecture says you're a hyperbolic three-manifold, and hyperbolic three-manifolds have lots of surface subgroups, which are codimension one. But that's sort of that's the case in which these intervals are not rigid, and maybe if they are rigid, there's a different argument to get. Yeah. Okay, so, well, the kinds of things that don't have locally separating arcs are the non-planar things, which is to say, if they're one-dimensional, basically Menger sponges. And now I think it's kind of hopeless to give a complete characterization of hyperbolic groups whose boundaries are Menger sponges, but I do want to give you an interesting some interesting examples of hyperbolic groups, so one direction. Lots of interesting examples of hyperbolic groups whose boundaries are Menger sponges and which we can actually show do embed in random groups. So these are going to be the diamonds. So, all right.
Danny, is it possible that there are groups with property T that have locally disconnecting arcs, and would we dash the hopes for a positive solution to that question?
I mean, it's possible. I don't know. So.
Why?
Well, it wouldn't. It's possible. I don't know. I don't know examples. I don't know examples. That'd be a great place to look. Yeah.
Why
don't
you say disconnected by an arc? Is that
Locally disconnected by an arc, so certainly being disconnected by an arc. Yes, even stronger. Okay, so my diamonds are. So I never heard of Artin groups until like 2 years ago, and now all of a sudden everyone's doing them everywhere. But I had heard of Coxeter groups, and it turns out, luckily, that Coxeter groups are related to Artin groups. And so the diamonds I want to talk about There's actually some examples of them I knew. These are certain kinds of beautiful coxeter groups which act. They're groups of reflection, convex co-compact reflection groups in hyperbolic space of any dimension. So, all right. What are we up to? Three. So, diamonds. So here are these coxeter groups. Okay, so in the hyperbolic plane, there are Euclidean triangles. There are Euclidean triangles. The hyperbolic plane or Euclidean triangles. In the hyperbolic plane, I'll try that again. In the hyperbolic plane, there are equilateral triangles. Much better. Where the angles are any angle less than whatever the angle is in Euclidean space, I guess 120 degrees. So in particular, you can find nice regular triangles in the hyperbolic plane, 60 degrees, where these angles are 2 pi over m for any m bigger than or equal to 7. I used to know what 2 pi was in degrees, and I've forgotten. But all right, and so these tile, these beautiful sort of regular tessellations of hyperbolic plane where you sort of fit some number of 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. Okay, good. Some number, at least 7, of these triangles around every vertex, and they sort of give you these nice, beautiful tessellations. And the group of symmetries of this tessellation is a nice example of a coxeter group. It's a very beautiful coxeter group. Coxeter groups come with little graphs with numbers on them, and this one comes with this graph. Anyway, there it is. And this group is the group of this. So this is the group of symmetries of this sort of tessellation here. And so every M gives you a nice group of symmetries here, and all these groups are commensurable, and they're all commensurable with pi 1 of every closed surface of genus at least 2. Okay. Well, you say, well, okay, if that's true in dimension 2, it must be true in every dimension by induction. And you start trying to draw a ideal regular simplex in, sorry, you have to try to draw a regular equilateral simplex in hyperbolic 3 space, and you can sort of do it, and the edges get bigger and bigger, and the vertices sort of head off to infinity, and the angles, the dihedral angles, well, they're getting small, but they're not getting small enough. I want 2 pi over 99, and I haven't got there yet. And you go all the way out to infinity, and you see that at infinity you have a regular ideal simplex where you have 2 pi over 6, I guess, at the dihedral angles here. So the angles here are all 2 pi over 6. And of course, they still give you this beautiful regular tessellation whose group of symmetries is a nice coxeter group. And the way you add a dimension is you just add one more dot to your coxeter graph. And so this is a great example. This group of symmetries is commensurable with the fundamental group of the complement of the figure 8 knot. As we all know because of Thurston, I guess unless we're Riley. But anyway, this is one of the most beautiful sort of examples in geometry and topology kind of coming together. And it's this wonderful, wonderful tessellation. But you sort of say, well, if I want 2 pi over 7, I want 2 pi over 8, I just can't do it. The simplex has got as big as it can possibly be. So here's another important lesson I learned from Bill. The lesson is a picture is a thing too. A picture itself is a mathematical object. And even if you drew that picture believing you were bound by certain rules, the picture doesn't care, and you can break the rules and see what happens. And so what we can do is we can say, well, it's just a picture. I can draw a bigger simplex than that. Here it is. There you go. All right. Well, not all of this simplex is in hyperbolic 3 space. What's in hyperbolic 3 space is a simplex with the corners kind of cut off. But it's nice and regular, and the dihedral angles, well, they keep getting smaller and smaller as you make this bigger and bigger and bigger. This is a super ideal simplex. And now you can make the dihedral angles 2 pi over m, where now m is allowed to be as big as you want. Great. And you can look at the group, that generates this, gets this nice symmetric tiling, the group of symmetries of this tiling, group of symmetries, and it's basically this Coxeter group, M dot, 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 whatever, this one here. And this is some beautiful group. It's not co-compact, it's convex co-compact, and its limit set is one of these beautiful Sierpinski carpets. So one of the things Henry and I do is to show that this particular guy, when M's big enough, for any random group with overwhelming probability, contains one of these groups, virtually contains one of these groups with overwhelming probability. So this is sort of beautiful, because I think it's sort of, the nicer the subgroup is, the more you kind of, I don't know, you have the more you can sort of do with it or something. So maybe it's sort of, this is a stretched analogy, but I kind of think that there's some sense in which the sort of, we've learned the value of embedding hyperbolic group, or virtually embedding hyperbolic groups in Coxeter groups or in Artin groups. Maybe there's also a value in virtually embedding Coxeter groups in hyperbolic groups. And that's sort of maybe there's a complementary picture there. I hope there's some sort of content to it. So this is great. And then this picture really does continue in arbitrary dimension. And it continues, and the way it continues is you just sort of draw this and then just keep adding dots. And then there you go, that's the Coxeter group, which is the group of symmetries of the super ideal, the tiling by super ideal regular simplices with dihedral angles 2 pi over m in d-dimensional space where I have d plus 1 dots. This is a beautiful convex co-compact reflection subgroup of hyperbolic d-dimensional space. And the limit space, the limit set of all of these, where d is 4 and bigger, the limit set of all of these is a Menger sponge. So you can't tell them apart by the topology of their boundaries, but they're different from each other. So we need a more refined kind of description of these groups or of their boundaries, which lets us distinguish these guys here. So I remember... Pardon me? Yeah, but let me finish what I was going to say and then state a theorem, but yes. So I remember reading, may have been written by Terry Wall, some appreciation of work of Thurston, in which he said that one of the characteristic features of Thurston's work was the prominent role that simplices played in them. And I think this is you know, I definitely learned to think in simplices by from Bill, and this was one kind of thing that was very important and continues to be important in my mathematical life. But again, we've learned that, well, simplices are great, but cubes are also tremendously great. Cubes are interesting too. You can do a similar thing with cubes. I can take cubes with dihedral angles 2 pi over m. In the plane, they're called squares. I get nice tilings from these guys. There are Coxeter groups. The only difference is we put a 4. In three-dimensional space, there are some beautiful, beautiful examples. One of them, if you make cubes here where the dihedral angles are 2 pi over 5, this is commensurable with, as we all know, the fundamental group of the Borromean rings orbifold with 4 fillings on the things, which I probably can't draw this, but it's not so bad. Let's pretend this is the Borromean rings. Yeah, you know what? I could do the draw and erase method, which is. Here's the benefit of the blackboard. You can draw and erase. Yeah. Well, all right, I'm not even going to do it. You know what the Borromean rings look like. The holes are too small for you to see up there. Okay, and so we all know, again, by Bill, and how many of us would have noticed this without him, that this orbifold group is commensurable with this beautiful sort of Coxeter group, and that's, I guess, 5 blank 4. Blank means 3, if you're sort of wondering. But again, you can make M get really big, and you need to take, again, you've got sort of these hyper, you know, whatever, super ideal Q cubes where the vertices burst out through infinity. You can get dihedral angles 2 pi over m for every m. And in every dimension, you can get super ideal cube Coxeter groups just by sort of taking these regular guys, making the dihedral angles 2 pi over m, looking at the nice tessellation, the group of symmetries. So the theorem is just that these random groups, let's stress this builds on sort of some previous work with Alden and with Henry. So for any, say, k greater or equal to 2, and any L at least 1 or density less than 1/2, this is the few relators or the density model. So for any random group, you want to sort of say that, which is not obviously trivial. And for any D, there exists virtually, meaning a finite index subgroup of a superideal D-dimensional simplex group and a superideal D-dimensional cube group for some big M. And M, you'd like M to be as small as possible. Those are somehow the beautifulest groups. You can't get M too small, but you can at least get it to be little o of N. I think that's right. You can get little o of n. Maybe you can get n over log n. I think it might be hard to get smaller than n over log n. Okay, but the statement here is that there are lots of these groups that they sort of exist. There's lots and lots of examples of them, very sort of symmetrical, and you can sort of find them in your random groups. So these are sort of the diamonds. I think I have 2 or 3 minutes left. So I wasn't going to say a lot about glass, but I'll say a lot less about it. The method of construction of these subgroups, I think itself is quite interesting. There are kind of separate phases in the construction. Well, in the initial construction, the idea is: what do we want to do? We've got this 2 complex, whose fundamental group is our random group G. I want to build a group that embeds in G. The way I'm going to do it is, I'm going to build a 2 complex that maps to the 2 complex of G in such a way that the image is injective. First of all, where do I get the 2 complex from? Well, the 2 complex, I'm going to build it out of pieces that look locally like the pieces I use to make the complex K. I take a bunch of disks, and the disks I think of them as Lego blocks or tiles or something. The boundaries of them I label by the words. Maybe I just pick one of the words, one random relator R. I write it as the boundary of my disk. I think of that as a tile. I take a bunch of these tiles, and I start gluing them together the way Bill would do with kindergarten kids. And the way, there's some rules for how I glue them together, which is the boundaries have labels, and when I glue edges together, the labels have to agree. And if I do that, then the resulting 2 complex comes together with a tautological map into my complex K, and so the fundamental group of the complex I build comes with a map to my group G. And so the claim is, it's just a combinatorial statement, if you have a bunch of these tiles, finite collection of tiles whose boundary is a random word of length n, it's a Lego problem. You can glue these things together in some combinatorial way to build something which is commensurable with the spines, the sort of dual spines of these superideal reflection simplex groups. Okay? And so you've built a group. You've built a complex whose fundamental group is commensurable with one of these Coxeter groups, and it comes with a tautological map over to your random group. So that's a combinatorial piece of the argument. How do you ensure that the image is injective? This is sort of somehow where geometry comes in. The trick is to build your spine, to build your two-dimensional complex in such a way that if you look at the one skeleton of it, the edges are very, very long. The edges are very, very long. You say, well, how many paths are there in the one skeleton of length n? Well, they grow, but they grow maybe by some small power. They grow by constant to the power of n over a big number. They grow by a small power of n in the exponent. Okay? And so if you think about it, what would it mean for this map not to be injective? It would mean that there's a loop in my one skeleton here, which is essential in my domain, which becomes trivial in the target. What becomes trivial in the target? Well, these extra relators that I throw in. So I'm adding all these random words. These random words is like someone who's shooting. He's got a lot of bullets, but he's got a terrible aim. So if I'm thin enough, I've got a pretty good chance of avoiding the bullets. So if the edges of the skeleton are very long, there aren't many paths. There aren't many chances for this person, this random mad shooter, to hit these loops in the skeleton. I survive. I'm injective. Okay, so that's a geometric component. The combinatorial component itself has sort of two pieces. One piece of them is kind of an initial step, which is kind of a random construction. You have an input, a big random word. You want to build at the end this very regular combinatorial object. There's only one way to do that, which is to approximately do it by a kind of random matching technique. And that almost works, except for something of very small mass. And then you have to work hard to adjust the mass of these bad exceptional bits to make them kind of go away and look okay. So similar techniques were used by Kahn and Markovitch in their proof of the Ehrenpreis conjecture, I think. Specifically, they did a very beautiful kind of correction argument. Another kind of version of this argument came in Peter Kivash recently solved a very old combinatorial problem, this construction of designs. And his method is exactly to sort of almost build these designs by a kind of random method, and then to sort of finesse the thing at the end by kind of adding and subtracting little correction terms. So it's very similar kind of structural similarity in the arguments. So that's how you make diamonds. There's sort of some manufacturing process, but there's some craftsmanship at the end where you have to do this delicate adjusting. So these subgroups that I wanted to refer to as glass, there's a different technique at the end to sort of adjust these bad bits, which is a more probabilistic method, has something in common with material science, the idea of kind of annealing or tempering glass or steel, where you kind of gradually raise the temperature just slightly above a critical temperature and then cool it very slowly and raise it and cool it, and only the bad bits kind of get pulled apart and re-kind of glued together. And this gives you some way of building lots of interesting subgroups, not quite Coxeter groups, but not diamonds, but glass, but in industrial quantity. I'm going to take 2 minutes just to raise two interesting open questions. All the subgroups I construct here are all quasi-convex. I didn't say it, but these subgroups, they're all quasi-convex. In fact, that's the only reason I know they're embedded, is that they're quasi-convex. They're even 1 plus epsilon quasi-convex on a big scale, if you know what that means. That's the only reason I know that they're there. Not only that, these are long-living subgroups. You can build these subgroups in the one related group, and the group lives as you add all the rest of the relators. It doesn't get killed by all these other relators. It's so thin, it avoids them all. That raises two natural questions. First of all, how can you construct distorted subgroups of random groups, groups which are not quasi-convex? So I talked to Nathan Dunfield about this, and he and Dylan Thurston have this great paper on random tunnel number one knots, don't fiber is the title, but random one relator two generator groups do have distorted subgroups, Nathan tells me. Probably, with positive probability. Yeah, and so your random group has lots of, it has lots of two generator, one relator subgroups that you start with and then add a lot more relators to it. Most of those, or a lot of them, have distorted subgroups. Some of them, I suspect, live till the end. So I believe there should be some distorted subgroups, but I think that's a very interesting thing to explore. The other thing which I think is worth exploring is, are there any fragile subgroups? These subgroups are all long-lasting. They build them at the start after adding one relation. They live while you add all the other relations. Are there any subgroups that pop into existence only at some specific density and then immediately die again? And I don't just mean that a particular group does that, but a particular kind of group. Is there an interesting class of groups that sort of you can construct them and they live for a brief moment and then disappear, like all of us?
Questions for Mr. Caligari?
There's one, Mr. Schlemmer.
So I just go right back to the beginning. Is,
So everything's
loud,
torsion-free, infinite, one-ended, hyperbolic. But hyperbolic has actually a constant. How does delta depend on d?
The question is, how does the delta hyperbolicity of it depend on what's d? Oh, d is the density. It doesn't depend much on the density. It depends on the word length n, and it's of order n, and that's the theorem of Jan Olivier, who exactly calculates delta. It depends in a constant way on d, but it depends linearly on n.
And
why don't you start, instead of firing the first group and adding later, start with a known group like the first, you didn't do the first group and add a bunch of long groups.
Yeah. Okay, the question was, instead of starting with a free group as a seed and adding relators, what happens if you start with, say, a surface group, hyperbolic hygienist surface, let's say, and then do the same thing? The same arguments all work. Everything goes through with a kind of a caveat. So Jan Olivier discussed exactly this kind of thing. You can look at hyperbolic random groups with a kind of arbitrary hyperbolic seed. Everything goes through in a very similar way. These constructions all work or should work. There's a sort of a caveat, which is that there's a certain kind of bad torsion which causes the phase transition earlier than you'd expect on purely entropy grounds. And so let's say for small density, everything should be fine, but exactly what happens when you get near that, if the group itself had bad initial torsion, could be in trouble. Okay, so the question is, in this particular model, all the relators have the same length. Is that crucial? So the answer is no. You can let the relator lengths vary. That's not a problem. You also don't even need them to be uniform, chosen with respect to the uniform probability. You could choose any Markov procedure for generating words, and then you'd have to be a little bit careful about density. It depends on the entropy of that Markov procedure. And even better than that, they don't actually have to be truly random. It's only a kind of pseudo-randomness is needed. So there's certain nice regular families of groups that you can produce that have lots of subgroups of this kind without having to invoke randomness.
So when you first did the overfull two-simplex in the plane,
yep,
you get virtually three groups. And then when you do the overfull three-simplex in H3, you get these Sierpinski gasket groups. You mentioned it briefly of what happens when you continue up in dimension. Are they all Menger curves?
Yeah, they're all Menger sponges. So disappointingly, the topology of the boundary doesn't tell you where they came from.
Starting
in dimension four. So you'd like, yeah, obviously just the topology is not quite enough to say.
Okay, so what you're doing is putting sort of a very, very non-random collection of Menger curves inside random Menger curves.
Yeah.
Is there some sort of intermediate scale between the very random ones and the random ones?
Well, because this is what I was trying to sort of allude to with this question, thing about glass. You want a more robust industrial strength procedure for building non-free infinite index subgroups. And so that works within a kind of a limited domain, but it's experimentally it works. I think it might be a good, very nice as an algorithm for actually constructing interesting groups, but the theoretical basis for it is not super.
Well, let me see. We are already 15 minutes over time.
That's not long.
But okay, you were asking earlier. Well, go ahead.
So if I give you a place I circle in the boundary of a random group, can you approximate it by your...
Yeah, the question is, if there's a quasi-circle in the boundary of a group, can you approximate it by these groups? I think the answer is yes. Similarly, if you had, yes.